This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. America's military, intelligence, and diplomatic services are gearing up for a long war against terrorism. My guest Tim Weiner covers intelligence for the New York Times. In yesterday's paper, he reported that the American retaliatory missile strikes on Afghanistan and the Sudan last week were just small battles in a war without foreseeable end. In today's Times, he writes about why military strikes aren't very effective against the terrorists hidden in the hills of Afghanistan. Weiner says that targeting this terrorist network, which is believed to be funded by Osama bin Laden, is different than fighting state-sponsored terrorism.
What makes the organization, such as it is, of Osama bin Laden different from the state-sponsored terrorist groups that were flourishing in the 1980s is that this guy doesn't have a headquarters, per se. There's no building that you can hit. There's no bunker in Iraq or clandestine intelligence cell in Tehran that you can fix as a target, either a literal target for missiles or a figurative target for spies. Bin Laden is different.
As you pointed out in your article yesterday in the Times, these terrorists are driven more by theology than politics. How does that complicate things for the United States' attempts to get back at the terrorists and to prevent future acts?
The group around Osama bin Laden has a grandiose vision. It's not simply to alter American foreign policy in the Middle East. It's to abolish the United States and to drive pro-American leaders of countries like Saudi Arabia and Egypt out of power and to their graves, and to establish a kind of a global Islamic nation that would reach from North Africa, across the Middle East, across Afghanistan and Pakistan, all the way to the Philippines, essentially to unify the nations of Islam as one. Now, this makes matters difficult. You can't reason very closely with a fellow like this. In the late 70s and early 80s, the United States, through its diplomatic and intelligence services, was able to reach a kind of understanding or something that approached an understanding with organizations like the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization. This is not a guy that you can talk to, Mr. bin Laden.
Bin Laden helped fund the Mujahideen against the Soviet Union in the 10-year war between Afghanistan and the Soviet Union. And the United States, since it was opposed to the USSR during the Cold War, we were funding the Mujahideen in their fight against the Soviet Union. So how close did the United States and bin Laden get during that period? Did we work directly with him?
It's unclear that there's no evidence that the CIA worked directly with bin Laden during the decade-long struggle of the Afghan people to rid themselves of their uninvited guests from the Soviet Union. They certainly had a common cause. Bin Laden was known to the CIA and to the United States as one of those nice Saudi benefactors who showed up in Peshawar, Pakistan, which was the political base of the Afghan resistance just east of the Khyber Pass that leads to Afghanistan. He set up charities, he set up guest houses. He himself, bin Laden, has said that he imported hundreds of tons of heavy equipment from Saudi Arabia. He's, of course, a construction engineer by trade, to build roads, to build tunnels, to build underground depots and bunkers for the Mujahideen. So, yes, they were in common cause, and that's when the guy shows up first in the files of the CIA. But as far as them sort of sitting down in a room and working together, there's no evidence of that.
What did the CIA give the Mujahideen in terms of arms and other training?
Right. When This story starts during the Carter administration, actually, back in 1979, Christmas week, when the Soviets invaded Afghanistan with 110,000 troops. President Carter and his National Security Council and his Director of Central Intelligence began immediately to try to send tens of millions of dollars of weaponry to the Afghan resistance. This effort grew and grew and grew during the Reagan administration until it became hundreds of millions of dollars a year, and in aggregate, roughly $3 billion of weaponry and war material made its way from the CIA's sort of global gun-running organization through the Pakistani intelligence service known as the ISI into the hands, or at least we hoped it was getting into the hands, of the Mujahideen. The Saudis matched this. It's like a fundraising drive on public radio, dollar for dollar. So the combined contribution of the United States and Saudi Arabia was about $6 billion, with a B, dollars over the decade.
So in a way, I mean, would you say that the victory that we helped give the Mujahideen in Afghanistan against the Soviet Union boosted their confidence that they could topple superpowers, and now they think they can topple the United States?
Well, Afghan guerrillas have a long history of dealing severely with superpowers. The British, when the British were the superpower in the region in the 1830s and 40s, 150 years ago, sent a 16,000-man expeditionary force to try and subdue the Afghans, and about five of them made it back 4 years later. These guys are tough. They are really tough, and they live and fight under circumstances that very few people in the world could sustain. These guys basically lived in the mountains and slept on rocks and lived on stale bread and tea for 10 years and kicked the Soviet Union out. They are not pushovers.
Tim Weiner is my guest. He covers intelligence for the New York Times. You reported on Afghanistan and went to Afghanistan in 87, 92, and 94. What's the closest that you got to actually visiting one of the terrorist camps?
Well, they weren't seen as terrorist camps in 87 and in 92. The closest I ever got in 94 to the two camps that the United States now says are being run as terrorist universities by Osama bin Laden was about 30 miles in the case, or 20, I guess, miles in the case of the one that the United States hit with cruise missiles last week, and about 2 miles in the case of one that's established in Kunar province to the north, in the northeastern corner of Afghanistan. There's nothing fancy here. I mean, these are above ground, huts made out of mud and sometimes camel dung and stick, and the fancier ones of concrete. And underground, basically fancy caves that are protected from weaponry fired at them. Now, the question is not what these camps look like so much as who comes there. After the Soviets left Afghanistan in 1989, but before the Soviet-backed government in Kabul, the Afghan capital, fell in 1992, in those 4 years, people came from all over the world, all over the Islamic world, to first Peshawar, Pakistan, and then over the Khyber Pass and the other mountain passes into Afghanistan. These were people from Egypt, they were from Sudan, they were from all over North Africa, they were from Palestine and Lebanon, they were from, some of them, Saudi Arabia. They were from all over the Islamic world, from Morocco to the Philippines. And they came to kind of take a drink from this cup, this winner's cup that the Afghan Mujahideen had filled. This was the first victory by an Islamic army over an infidel invading force since the 16th century. It was a big deal. And they came to kind of drink from this cup of jihad, of holy war, and to learn what the Afghans had learned, and to export this holy war and the techniques of fighting it back to their homelands. They became what were known as the Afghan Arabs.
One of the things that's really hard to reconcile is this. The people behind the holy war see the United States as being the infidels, as being immoral. But Afghanistan is a large exporter of heroin. So how do the people fighting the holy war reconcile their morality with heroin?
That's an interesting question, and I'm not sure I know the answer. It is true that there's no more economy in Afghanistan. The endless wars, first against the Soviet Union, and then Afghan against Afghan, that have gone on now for more than 20 years, have destroyed Afghanistan. There's almost nothing left in Afghanistan except acre upon acre upon acre of poppies from which opium is produced and heroin refined. Afghanistan may be responsible for anywhere from a quarter to a third of the heroin consumed by junkies in the United States. These estimates are necessarily imprecise. How do they reconcile it? I'm not sure they do reconcile it. You know, the Quran says that such intoxicants are immoral. But one gets a sense that the folks who have lived and fought out there for so long are nothing if not pragmatic. And if that's the only way to get currency into Afghanistan, so be it.
Now, a lot of the terrorist network is funded by bin Laden's money, and he has, you said he has an estimated $250 million from the fortune his father made building mosques, palaces, and public works for the Saudi royal family. Do you think the CIA or, you know, American intelligence is trying to get to bin Laden's money? Because that's his main contribution, right, is the dough.
Yeah, that's the... I think you could say that the infrastructure of bin Laden's network is cash rather than a building or a formal a set of training centers. Nobody knows how much money the guy has. He was one of 20 sons of his father, and the sons shared a fortune estimated at $5 billion. So his cut would have been about $250 million. He may have quite a bit more. According to one estimate, he brought as much as $500 million to the Sudan when he set himself up there for business 4 or 5 years ago. This money is hidden in a maze that has thus far proved impenetrable to the United States, and if you could take it down and seize it, I suppose you could paralyze his operations. The money is probably stashed away in a global network of Islamic banks, which function different from your friendly neighborhood savings and loan, and probably with a network of money changers in Pakistan and Afghanistan who function as banks. And where else? Who knows? It's a pretty interesting detective story that will probably go on for years.
My guest is Tim Weiner. He covers intelligence for the New York Times. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Tim Weiner. He covers intelligence for the New York Times. We're talking about last week's retaliatory missile strikes against the terrorist network in Sudan and Afghanistan, a network funded by Osama bin Laden. The network is believed to be behind the bombings of two American embassies in Africa. The government of Sudan is saying that the factory we bombed was a pharmaceutical plant that had nothing to do with chemical weapons, as the CIA claims it did. The CIA says it has evidence to back up the claim, but it can't disclose the information to the press or the public. I asked Tim Weiner if, as a reporter, he's willing to accept that.
As a reporter, I understand why CIA is loath to disclose the sources and methods it uses to reach the conclusions that it does. There is a great deal of secrecy, of course, involved in what they do, and they feel that if they are in a position of being forced to say, well, a guy we work with, you know, in the Sudan who's been secretly assisting the United States undercover for the last 14 years told us, that that could put the fellow's life in danger. It is true that the degree of secrecy surrounding the military operations against Sudan and Afghanistan were about as secretive as anything since World War II, in that, you know, the Pentagon didn't say, we sent thus and such a ship to thus and such location and fired thus and such weaponry. This is something new under the sun. In my opinion, the ability of whoever carried this out, and let's say for the moment that it was Osama bin Laden and his network, to carry out two simultaneous bombings in two different locations, that's something new under the sun. The level of logistical sophistication, timing, training necessary to pull that off is high. As one former CIA officer said, two at once is not twice as hard as one. Two at once is 100 times as hard. So the United States is saying to itself and to its people, we're up against something new here, and we are going to have to fight it in new and different ways. Whether cruise missiles are effective in taking down part of a global terrorist structure remains to be seen. This kind of thing, if this war, if it is a war, as they say, this war is going to go on for years.
Are there new strategies being debated that you're aware of?
I think that the United States is saying to itself and to its people that this is not the moral equivalent of war. This is war. And this is going to be similar in some ways, perhaps in duration, to the Cold War. And they are going to use some of the same tools that they used during the Cold War, that is, spies and secret operations, and perhaps paramilitary operations run by the Pentagon or by the CIA. And they are going to try and dream up some new techniques. Now, the problem here is that fighting this kind of war is disproportionately dependent on good intelligence. About 80 or 90% of the game is good intelligence. And it is very, very, very hard for the United States to penetrate an organization like Osama bin Laden's. It's very hard for the United States to place a spy in their camp. We don't have a lot of spies that look like these guys. We don't have a lot of guys who can speak the language literally and figuratively that these guys speak. And to gin up the talent that you need to penetrate and take down an organization like this one is a big, big task.
Have there been any estimates about how much damage this terrorist network can actually do?
If we take Mr. bin Laden's public statements at face value, this is a man who has vowed to attack American bases overseas anywhere at any time. While there's no proof that he was the intellectual authors of the bombings at American military bases in Saudi Arabia in 1995 and 1996, which killed 24 American soldiers, he has, after the fact, applauded those bombings. And if the senior officers of United States military and intelligence and diplomatic services are right, he was planning two or three or possibly more attacks like the bombings that took out the American embassies in Africa 2 weeks ago. It's impossible for an outsider to evaluate how good the American intelligence information on this guy is. They claim it's extraordinarily good, but they're not going to show it to the press or to the American people.
Tim Weiner, thank you very much for talking with us.
All right, thanks.
Tim Weiner covers intelligence for the New York Times. We recorded our interview this morning. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.